Wall Street veteran Bernard Madoff has been arrested and charged with running a $50 billion Ponzi scheme.
Congress wants to know what caused the Enron meltdown.
Now, while the collective rage currently is focused on WorldCom,
Tyco CEO Dennis Kozlowski was convicted of looting hundreds of millions of dollars.
This is one of the biggest fraud cases ever.
Their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Find out more on this week's episode of White Collars, Red Hands.
The 1980s were a time of excess. As the economy boomed in the post-Vietnam War era, everything was getting bigger, from hair to bank accounts. In addition to this, Reaganomics gave large tax cuts to the wealthy and deregulated many industries, which created a complete Wild West mentality of corporate America. This deregulation led directly to many shady practices throughout numerous markets. One of those was energy, which led to the rise and eventual downfall of Enron. And on the investment side, it was also the best of times. When money is flowing, no one really pays attention to if those making the profit are playing by the rules, because everyone is just having a good time. And that is why the 1980s are considered the decade of greed, as Wall Street became filled with wild characters who would do anything to make a buck. One of these characters was Ivan Boesky, a King Charles lookalike that came from nothing to being one of the richest men on the planet in just about 5 years. He seems to have impeccable talent for winning every hand dealt to him when he started trading. But as it turns out, the deck might have been stacked the whole time, and Ivan still had some aces up his sleeve.
Damn, what an unfortunate lookalike.
He looks like, just like a tall, old, sickly British man. So, King Charles. like to a T. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of White Collars, Red Hands. I'm Kashan.
And I'm Nina.
And today we're talking about Ivan Boesky, another one of those big Wall Street characters that inspired some actual Wall Street characters, but you'll find out about that in a little bit. So, let's just get right down to it. What do you say, Nina?
Let's get to it.
The fucking podcast trope. Let's get right down to the story.
Let's just do it.
Let's just get to it. And then they talk for an extra 5 minutes.
Like what we're doing right now.
Yeah. Oh, man, we're nailing this podcast thing. Anyway, Ivan Boesky was born into a middle-class Russian immigrant and Jewish family in lovely Detroit, Michigan on March 6th, 1937. His family did own a string of businesses throughout the city, but small joints like delis and bars, which everywhere called a delicatessen, and I'm like, I'm not using the full name.
Is that what a deli is short for, delicatessen?
Yeah, delicatessen.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
It's like when you learn out that a tarp is short for tarpaulin. When I found that out, I was like, wild.
No, we don't need to say all that.
That is a tarp.
That's a tarp.
And nothing, there are no more letters to that.
I would enjoy a bar deli moment, though.
A bar deli combo?
That's just a restaurant. Yeah, like, honestly, a strip club that was also a deli. I would love that.
Well, we'll get to it.
Shaving ham while I look at your ham. Love it.
Why are you working at the deli?
I'm not working at the
deli. Well, why are you shaving your own ham? That's the deli workers.
They're shaving my ham.
You said, I'm shaving ham while watching your ham. That was the exact sentence you said.
I did work at a deli.
Stop trying to gaslight me.
I didn't mean to. I just don't know what I say.
Ivan Boesky graduated from Mumford High School. I think the Sons went there, too.
Yeah, that's what I heard, actually.
Mumford and the Sons. And then he went on to try his luck at multiple universities, including Wayne State, Eastern Michigan, and the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. But he never left any of those with a degree.
But he did leave with syphilis.
Yeah, I mean, it was the time.
It was.
Right? It's the 1950s. You're not a cool guy if you're not having your three martini lunches and getting a little syphilis on the side, all right? All right?
Shows you're a real man.
Nevertheless, he was still accepted into Detroit College of Law without an undergraduate degree.
How?
I'm so glad you asked. It actually turns out that's a thing. There is no formal requirement to get into a law program. It's really unusual, especially nowadays, to get admitted into a law program without an undergrad degree. But even now, you can technically still get accepted. There are still a lot of programs that don't require an undergrad degree to get into law school.
I did not know that.
So he did that. And he did actually graduate from this one. So maybe he found his calling. And he immediately began working as a law clerk. So in his 20s, he also began his business career, how most people do, through nepotism. He helped the family business working in the delis and the pubs they owned, including one that supposedly also operated a strip joint to the basement. A bar, not a deli, but I guess... I mean, technically, they just said it was a rumor, so maybe it was the basement of a deli, and you could live out your dream.
Could you imagine just eating a fat ham and cheese sandwich, mustard on the side of your chin, watching a girl slide down the pole? That's heaven.
Why are you getting ham and cheese from a deli? Right?
Well, okay, get a fucking Reuben.
Thank you. I was like, get a pastrami. Get a Reuben. Get something interesting that's not like what you can get at the Jewel, you know?
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
Which is our, like...
Grocery store
in Chicago, for those of you who aren't from Chicago.
Yeah.
We're not talking about like a fucking jewelry store, no. Which would be a weird, just as weird place to get a ham and cheese as a strip club.
Yes.
It is around this time that he also met Seema Silberstein. That's Silberstein with a B. Just, never heard that one before. Mm-hmm. And also Seema. Seema was the daughter of prominent...
It was a prominent Seema, all right.
But she was the daughter of a prominent Detroit real estate mogul, Ben Silberstein, who had amassed a decent fortune and collection of properties, the crowning jewel of which was the Beverly Hills Hotel located at 9641 Sunset Boulevard in, guess where, Beverly Hills, California. Ben bought the motel in... 1954 for $6 million, and it would garner great history as a hotel to the stars. Fun fact, the Eagles' song, Hotel California, is inspired by the Beverly Hills Hotel, and the album cover, which also has the name Hotel California, has a picture of it on their album. So, Boesky married into the family that owns that hotel for whatever that's, cool. that's worth. You have a little fun fact now. Ivan would go on to marry the young Silberstein woman at the age of 25 in 1962. And you're probably thinking that Ivan married a woman with such a lovely name as Seema because he was deeply in love with her. Many people, though, including Boesky's own father, would disagree with you and say that he married her for purely financial reasons. She also kind of looks like someone like sewed a face on her, like how the Joker did in the new 52 Batman comics, and where he stapled his own face back on. She kind of looks like that. But I can only find pictures when she's older, so she might have just got some really bad nip tucks.
Yeah.
You know? But whatever. So if he did marry her for purely financial reasons, it did start to pay some pretty nice dividends pretty fast, as after working for a few years in various stock brokerage firms in New York, Boesky used a small loan of $700,000, about $4.1 million worth of loan today, from his new father-in-law to bankroll his own brokerage company, Ivan F. Boesky & Company, in 1975. Which is a terrible sequel to Oliver and Company.
It is.
Billy Joel didn't write the music for this one, so it's just, you know...
It was a flop.
Yeah, it fell flat on its face. Over the next decade, Ivan Boesky would become one of the richest people in America through this business, and would do so in a manner that earned him the nickname Ivan the Terrible.
Oh, that's original.
Yeah, no one's ever had that name before.
Never. He's the first.
Not... once. I don't know anything about the real Ivan the Terrible.
I
probably did some bad stuff. Right?
I
mean,
I heard it was terrible.
Probably did some bad stuff. Probably killed some people. I'm just going to assume. You know what? Us here at White College Red Hands, we're going to take the very bold stance of saying we don't side with Ivan the Terrible.
Not here, not on this podcast.
Ivan the Terrible is officially canceled.
Oh yeah.
All right, and you heard it here.
You
first.
Heard it here.
Run to Twitter and please make. Cancel Ivan the Terrible trending as quickly.
Cancel the Terrible.
As quickly as possible. It's not even Twitter anymore. That's how in the know we are. Boesky made his money as an arbitrageur, And you're probably wondering, what the hell is that? Unless, of course, you are a previous listener and or just a little smart cookie.
Well, I do this podcast and I forget what it is.
Well, for those of you who aren't a little smart cookie, like Nina here, you're like a dumb bagel. Yeah.
Thought you were going to call me a dumb bitch.
Oh, no. I would
only, a dumb bagel's
better. I would only think that. I've never say that to your face.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're very welcome. For those of you who aren't, arbitrage is the buying of an investment in one market and the selling of it in another to exploit market inconsistencies.
Yes.
One example from previous episodes of ours would be Sam Bankman-Fried, who originally amassed a lot of his money by exploiting a slight difference in the price of crypto in America, and I believe it was China, and would buy large volumes at moderately cheaper in one market to sell them in another for a profit. Ivan Boesky did something similar, but within the same market. I feel like arbitrage is a very loose term here, because he would basically buy securities of companies in large volumes and bet that the price was going to rise in the near future, which just kind of sounds like stocks to me. So if someone knows the actual difference, then just let me know. But usually because they were on the verge of potentially getting acquired, like there was takeovers were really popular in the 1980s, like hostile takeovers, corporate takeovers, and a lot of mergers going on. So he's basically buying stock, betting on one of those to happen. If the company did get acquired or merged with another company, the price of its stock would rise, maybe not exponentially, but enough, and Boesky would make a hefty profit based on the volume that he had bought. There's also inherent risk, like there is with all trading, as mergers and takeovers fall through or get blocked by regulators all the time. Well, maybe they weren't getting blocked by regulators in the 1980s,
yeah,
but they are now, but still. Boesky quickly proved that he could be a savvy trader and also blamed it all on his ability to do his due diligence to know more than anyone else in the world about companies and about potential trades. He once said that he wanted to get every morsel of information that was out there. And those close to him said that he was a workaholic. He only slept about 4 hours every night. He drank copious amounts of coffee, which he called like vampire fuel or something crazy like that.
This is my vampire fuel.
Yeah, give me my vampire fuel. It's not that, but it's something very similar.
What's that one coffee that's super potent?
Oh, the Oleato, the one that makes you shit yourself?
I don't think it's called that.
No, that's the Starbucks. They just released one.
Oh, the one with olive oil?
Yeah, and olive oil like will make you poop, and yeah. Coffee makes you poop. So I guess like putting it together
is like a double enema.
Yeah.
So it's like a coffee enema.
So if you're constipated, you go out and get an Oleato, because supposedly it'll grease your insides.
No, there's a coffee that has like four times the amount of caffeine in it.
Espresso?
No.
You're talking about Death Wish coffee, the strongest coffee on the planet?
And that's what he would drink. That's his vampire juice.
Yo, my old roommate would only drink that. And that man's going to die.
Not good for you.
Early. But yes, that was his vampire juice, whatever the hell we called it. And also, he had his ear to the ground to get as much information as possible. There's a popular myth that we are never more than 3 feet away from a spider at any given time.
I'm a Black Widow.
Okay. You have to get married first to be a Black Widow.
Maybe I have been married and I just ate my husband's and you don't know it.
That's not what a Black Widow is. That's a cannibal. What are you talking about? That's just, you can just kill them. You don't have to eat them. Jesus.
They're tasty. Doesn't the Black Widow spider eat her husband?
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of bugs do that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Praying mantis, I think, is the most famous example. But yeah. I think Black Widows do it too. I don't know. Anyway, that's wrong. You're not always 3 feet away from a spider, maybe on average, but that's a terrible way to do statistics. What was true, though, is that Ivan Boesky was like this, but with telephones. This is in the 1980s. So, like, yeah. Right now, you're used to always having a phone on you and being able to call anyone, ever, whatever.
Back then, you were not 3 feet near a phone hardly at all.
No, and like conference calls and stuff. It's crazy. He literally had at his desk, he had like three or four phones that had a that was attached to a switchboard that mm-hmm. could hold 300 calls at a time.
Whoa.
There's a famous picture of him holding like two phones, one in each hand, and also one like cradled in his between his shoulder and his ear.
Was he actually talking to three people at once? Or
yeah, supposedly he'd literally be talking to someone, like hang up and like get someone else on the line while talking to someone else, and just his whole this whole switchboard would be like lit up like a Christmas tree, and he would just be like talking to a bunch of people all at the same time.
Seems counterproductive.
Yeah, I'm about to say, I was like, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's the ADHD, but I couldn't remember shit. Mm-hmm. Like, if I get to another phone call, I forget what you just told me on the first one. So, like, if I can't write it down, I'm fucked.
Yeah.
But whatever. He even had three phones, three in his private chauffeured car.
No.
Three car phones, dude. No. That's crazy.
That is crazy. That is unhinged behavior.
And this is back when, like, car phones were... like a briefcase.
Right. Yeah, like, they were enormous. You watch movies from that time and like it's literally bigger than your face.
Yeah, so you got three of those?
No, thanks.
All right.
I'm good.
All of his hard work shot Boesky's net worth up to $200 million, which is about $500,000 today, by 1986. But to put that into perspective, less than half of that actually came from his business and the arbitrage. A large portion of his wealth once again came from his wife. When Ben Silberstein died in 1979, he left his portion of the hotel equally to both of his daughters, Muriel Slatkin and Seema Boesky now. Boesky, this time, Ivan Boesky, did not want to keep the hotel and wanted to sell it, which Muriel was deeply opposed to. She was like, no, we got to keep the hotel. It's literally like the biggest thing our dad had. So Ivan showed just how slimy he could be when he went around and bought the remaining 5% of the hotel from other investors that had it to have a majority stake so that they could then sell the hotel right out from under his sister-in-law.
That's shitty.
And he ended up selling it to... the one-time owner of 20th Century Fox, Marvin Davis.
What did Marvin do with it?
He sold it less than a year later to the Sultan of Brunei.
What?
And they actually, they still own it to this day. Like, the Beverly Hills Hotel is still around. It's a very fancy hotel. You can still go there. And Brunei still owns it. And they've actually been boycotted, like, multiple times because it turns out Brunei has recently taken harder and harder stances against homosexuality. Like
In 2024?
They've been getting stricter. In, like, 2014, they made homosexuality illegal and punishable by death by stoning.
What?
Like, they enacted that law in 2014. They didn't, like, still have it.
There are so many other things to be concerned about.
And they also own... a chain of luxury hotels, by the way. There's a whole holding company that's owned by Brunei.
Weird.
That they own a bunch of fancy hotels all across the world.
It's so random.
Including the Beverly Hills Hotel. So for Ivan Boesky's underhandedness and willingness to do anything to close a deal, he became known as Ivan the Terrible amongst the Wall Street elite. So I guess not... He didn't really do anything like that bad. It was just, and it wasn't even about his like hard.
He just seems like he was super shady.
I think it's about the conquering. Like he was, he was like not going to take no, and he just kept winning. So they called him Ivan the Terrible, I guess. He also possessed a scary presence, as many said he looked like a skeleton man dressed always in a black three-piece suit. He would only wear a black three-piece suit, and he was also quick to anger if something had gone wrong.
He kind of looks like Slender Man.
A little, yeah. Also, when speaking to the press, he always had this really extremely like creepy, like huge, terrible grin on that reminds me of, do you know who Joel Osteen is?
Yeah, I know. Do I know who Joel Osteen is?
I figured you would.
Absolutely. I've made love with Joel Osteen, okay? On multiple occasions. I know who Joel Osteen is.
What?
Okay, that was made up, but I know who he is.
I'm about to say, I was like,
I've just made love to his sermons.
in the background?
Yeah.
That's weird, dude. You're going to hell, man.
No, it's just like, God bless. I'm kidding. I know who Joel Osteen is.
Anyway, you know how he's always got that fucking shitting and grin?
Yeah, he's an idiot.
And it looks like fake?
He's shitty, yeah.
Yeah, it's like that. That's what Ivan Boesky had, but he looks like a tall, a British skeleton. He looks British, even though he's not British.
Yeah, he does.
I don't know British. How else better to describe he that, but he does. He has
British energy.
He does. He looks like you're going to see him at tea time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. He loves some crumpets. He absolutely wants no seasoning in his food. Mm-hmm. His idea is spicy is fish and chips.
Chinese food comes in a bag.
Absolutely.
With fries.
Yeah. With fries.
Or chips. Chips. Yeah. So,
peas.
So that was really unsettling. And that combined with this fucking pinky ring he always wore really makes me think I would dislike being alone in a room with him. He looks like he's going to try and touch me.
Oh, he wouldn't try to touch you. He would succeed touch you.
With that pinky ring. Furthering that idea is his willingness to relish in the excess of his wealth. He was rich and he wanted everyone to know it. He would often take a private helicopter from his office in Manhattan to his 12-bedroom mansion in the countryside. And there's even a story that gets passed around of how he once went to one of the nicest restaurants in New York and then proceeded to order every item on the menu, like just to try it. So they brought all the dishes out. He'd take a bite and then he'd be like, all right, take it away. Like he just wanted to try everything, but not actually like eat any of it completely.
That's annoying.
So that's the kind of like excess that he was into. And, yeah. And he didn't fucking care. Because he also loved to hear himself talk. He was the first arbitrage trader to hire his own public relations firm. Something that I'm pretty sure is probably commonplace nowadays. If you have enough money, you're probably just going to have a public relations firm in your payroll. And through this, he found himself talking with the media, getting adjunct business professorships at different colleges, and speaking at commencement ceremonies throughout the country. At one of these ceremonies, he gave a speech that has now become one of the most infamous events in Boesky's life. When speaking to the graduates of the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, Boesky said, and I quote, "I feel greed is healthy. I believe you can be greedy and still feel good about yourself."
Oh, wow.
A disgustingly self-indulgent quote that encapsulates the idea of 1980s Wall yeah. Street. So much
That's
so.
That's crazy that he's giving a commencement speech saying that.
And that was, so that's like the famous quote. That was like the whole speech was basically about mm-hmm. that, about yeah. how greed is good for the economy and for people. And it was so encapsulating of the 1980s on Wall Street that it literally inspired the greed is good speech delivered by the fictional character Gordon Gekko in the movie Wall Street. I don't know if you've seen it, but there is a famous part where he goes up and he said, "Greed, for the lack of a better term, is good." And it was inspired by this commencement speech that Boesky gave. Boesky also wrote a book on risk arbitrage called Merger Mania. That PR team was really doing a terrible job. That's what they decided to name this book. I haven't read it. I'm just going to be honest with you. I did not read Merger Mania. But the book does hold a 3.6 out of 5-star rating on Goodreads.
That's not bad.
17 reviews. One review was written, though. And here that is. Ivan is a slimy rat who wrote this incredibly boring book in an attempt to show that he was a genius, not a thief. He failed on all fronts. I have kept this book in mint condition to remind me of what he did. By Don McNay.
Wow.
Sorry that Ivan Boesky hurt you so much, Don.
Yeah, Don has some feelings about this.
Also, you own the book.
You bought the book.
So a little bit counterproductive there, Don.
Yeah, that's like it's like when you really hate someone on social media and then you view their videos because you like want to be mad at them. Like, you know what I mean? You want to watch their content to like fuel your anger, but then you're like, wait a minute, I'm boosting their
just
algorithm.
Giving all their money back.
Yeah.
That's what they want you to do.
Cardi B said, "Thank you to all my haters who listen to my music." Basically, she said like the same thing, like, "Thank you to all my haters who've listened to my music because you've all made me money."
Yeah, you've all listened to my music. I mean, yeah. In some ways, any attention is good attention, right?
To an extent.
When you're a content creator, yeah, unless you're like really getting raked over the coals for something that you did. So what did Boesky do that made Don McNay so upset? Well, Boesky might have been doing his deals on the up and up for a while, but we know that things started to turn criminal at least after a failed takeover bid for City Services, a precursor to the petroleum company now known as Citgo. Boesky found himself rarely on the wrong side of the deal, as he had bet for the takeover to happen and lost $60 million in the process, which, you know, pretty decent chunk of change for the 1980s. Because of this, Boesky decided that his 300 phone lines just weren't enough to get him every morsel of information, and he instead decided to offer kickbacks to bankers that provided him with insider information. The first of which was a man named Martin Siegel, an investment banker with Kidder Peabody & Company. When a company would come to his bank looking for help in securing capital for a takeover or with help on a merger, Siegel would pass this information on to Boesky, who could buy just in time to see a huge price increase in the stock. And this is where I'll just throw in like a brief, like, what is insider trading? Basically, if you come into contact with any information that's not publicly available or publicly disclosed from a public company, and you still buy stocks without notifying somebody that you came into contact with the information and you profit from it, that's insider trading. Mm-hmm. And over the next 4 years, from 1982 to 1986, this information, this insider trading information that Siegel provided Boesky, netted him profit in excess of $33 million. This is still not enough to make up for that $60 million mm-mm, loss, but no. this is just one banker. He had multiple. And for this, Siegel was paid $700,000 in kickbacks, so equal to that original loan that Boesky got from his family that started the whole thing. It was also around this... Jesus. It was also around this time that a Swiss bank, Bank Leu, was coming under investigation by the U.S. government for seemingly always making picks that were winning, and just days before huge stock increases. Through the investigation, they found out that Bank Leu wasn't acting on insider trading information, at least not directly, but they were rather mimicking the trades of one of their account holders. They noticed this man's investments never seemed to lose, so whenever he made an investment, the bank made a large one right along with it. And without this volume added to these trades to the bank, it's possible that the account holder, who would later be revealed to be Dennis Levine, would never really have gained much attention by the authorities, and Boesky might have remained a free man. Who knows? To this day. Probably not, but maybe. But as it stands, the bank told investigators that Dennis was their man. There was a little bit that I didn't go into. There was like a holdout in the investigation where they like called him Mr. Diamond. Weird.
Did he sell diamonds? Did he have anything to do with diamonds?
Absolutely not.
Oh.
Levine was actually an investment banker at Drexel Burnham Lambert, home of the junk bond king himself, Michael Milken. If you want to learn more about Michael Milken and all of the bevy of crimes that go along with him, you can actually check out an episode we've already done on him detailing his side of the story called Milken the Cash Cow. But briefly, he created a market for these junk bonds that fueled multiple leverage buyouts in the 1980s. So his firm was in very good position to be in knowledge of when corporate takeovers were going to happen, because they funded most of them in the 1980s. Boesky knew this and had multiple meetings with Dennis Levine, where Levine agreed to pass information to Boesky for a 5% kickback of all of the profits that were gained from this information, which turned out to be 5% of $50 million over the course of those 4 years.
So a lot of money.
So that's $83 million between two bankers, if you're counting at home.
Damn.
Boesky also did business with Milken directly, at one point writing him a check for $5.3 million that would later come back as a key piece of information in Milken's downfall. This kind of insider trading that Boesky was dealing in was definitely illegal at the time. It was first illegalized in the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, but it was never really enforced. But this blatant use of non-public information for kickbacks at this extreme of volume definitely interested the feds. Basically, they kind of knew. It's like, yeah, most people are going to know a little bit about, like, people talk.
Right, right.
But this, like, organized scheme of, like, getting the information and paying them a kickback for it, that's always going to carry with it an extra level of, like, of criminality in, like, the feds' eyes, right? So when Dennis Levine got hauled in, he immediately was like, eh, I'll tell you about all the other people.
Wow, what a little bitch.
That's what they do, man.
Yeah, they do.
They're not hardened criminals. They get caught and they'll immediately start telling you about everyone else. Yeah. Without this testimony, it would have also been hard to catch Boesky, as there's no law that requires arbitrageurs to keep a comprehensive record of trades performed. So it just would have been difficult to really understand when, how, and why he was making his money. When Boesky eventually does get pulled in, he decides he wants a deal similar to Dennis Levine, telling investigators that he has an even bigger fish to hand over to them in Michael Milken.
Oh, wow.
As well as a smattering of others, as he ratted out a string of investment bankers that had provided him information throughout the years. And by the way, if you do go back and listen to that Milken episode, the feds were not, they didn't suspect Milken at all. He had a really good public image at this time. And he actually recovered his public image afterwards, too. He was really good at that. So without Boesky coming in, they would have never gone after Michael Milken, even though Michael Milken
deserved it.
His fraud was a lot more, like $650 million, I think, is around where it was, if I remember correctly. So investigators even had Boesky wear a wire to try and get Milken to admit to providing Boesky with insider information, which Milken was smart enough not to admit to during the meeting. But that check, that $5.3 million check, was kind of enough to give them a link. And Michael Milken obviously did eventually get convicted. As for Boesky, he tattled on enough people to only receive a slap on the wrist sentence of 3 years for the one count of conspiracy to commit securities fraud that he had agreed to plead guilty to as part of the deal. The judge cited that his willingness to cooperate heavily at the sentencing. And out of the 3 years, Boesky only served 22 months.
Of course.
Before being released, but was also banned for life from securities trading in the United States. On top of this, he was also ordered to pay $100 million, $50 million of which went to pay back the investors, and the remainder being a fine paid to the U.S. Treasury, which is actually supposedly a lot less money than the gains that he got from this. So
it doesn't it's not a real punishment.
It doesn't feel a lot like justice, but we'll see in a second that it led to changes to make that happen in the future. On top of that, his wife Seema, who was a large reason that Boesky ever made it this far, kind of the only reason, she divorced him after his release from prison. The divorce was bitter and hard fought, with Boesky asking for alimony in the amount of $1 million a year from her. In the end, Seema did pay out a one-time settlement of $23 million to him.
Whoa.
And agreed to alimony payments of $180,000 a year for the rest of his life.
Honestly, he can live very, very comfortably even today. Like, I know that $180,000 today is not the same as it was in the 80s, but you can still live pretty damn comfortably on $180,000 a year, plus a lump sum of $23 million. I need to marry a rich man and get divorced.
Wait, isn't the median salary in America something like $70,000?
Yes.
So this is like more than double the median.
It. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you can live pretty fine with this.
You would not have to get a job.
No, and he hasn't since then. I mean, what are you going to do?
Also, well, yeah, right? You've been in huge-ass trouble.
Like, if you don't need to, you're not going to go fucking work at a Barnes & Noble.
No, there's no reason to.
Boesky has since remarried and has lived in quiet anonymity to this day. He is still alive and living in La Jolla, California at the ripe age of 87.
He's old.
He is old. After this whirlwind of insider trading, the U.S. did increase punishments with the Insider Trading and Securities Fraud Enforcement Act of 1988, which was a direct, not retaliation, but a direct response to Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken, which allowed the SEC to seek civil penalties of insider traders and also strengthened both the maximum monetary penalties and the maximum prison terms for insider trading. So Ivan Boesky was the first in a long line of people who have exploited insider trading to reap ill-gotten gains. When it comes to the market, though, it seems difficult to prosecute this kind of crime. Rich people, they hang out at the same rich people parties together, sharing caviar and killing a man for sport. So, of course, they're going to bring up the workings of their companies, even if they aren't supposed to. This in itself is gross and indicative of the morals of America. But Boesky took it to a new level by not only profiting off of it, but setting up many crime syndicates of bankers to trade information through kickbacks. He may have gotten a slap on the wrist, but at least we can sleep a little more peacefully knowing that this incident made it harder for others after him. So sorry, Martha, you got Boesky'd.
She sure did.
She got Boesky'd.
She sure did.
Ivan Boesky walked so Martha Stewart could run to prison.
Right, exactly. Into the jail cell.
Right into the clink. So that is the story of the biggest, I think probably the biggest insider trading bust.
Oh, yeah.
Of all time.
Probably.
In Ivan Boesky, that slender man motherfucker. So thank you guys for listening. If you were tickled by today's episode, just absolutely tickled pink, then you can go ahead and you can show us. You can tickle us right back.
All please right. Do not tickle me.
No, you can tickle us right back over on our socials.
You can tickle Kashana.
Facebook.com/whitecollarsredhands. Send at tickled to us in a DM and we'll just laugh our little fucking heads off over here. You can also tickle us over at Instagram, whitecollars_redhands. Tickle us over on X at whitecollarspod. You can tickle us on TikTok, tickle talk. At White Collars Red Hands. You can also support us for free by writing a review. If you want to leave a review with words, you can write #tickled in the review if you'd like. But that's only going to be on Apple Podcasts. Can you put it down in words? You can give us stars and we'll take a 5-star review as a hint that you were trying to tickle us on any of the other services, but especially on Spotify. It's the second biggest one. Mm-hmm. So please do it there. If you want to get a hold of us, you can also do so through our website. You can go to the contact form there on whitecollarsredhands.com. That sends it straight to our email, so feel free to send it directly. Hey, I want to tickle you to whitecollarsredhands@gmail.com. And while you're over there, why don't you get comfy while you're giving us a little tickle too? You get the bit's gone on so long and it's going to keep going. I will not let it end. You could do so by getting a sweatshirt, White Collars Red Hands on it, and just one that looks so funny if you're wearing one and you're making Nina a giggle by tickling her in her White Collars Red Hands merch. You can check that out on our website. The link says check out our merch, whitecollarsredhands.com. You really want to help us? Why don't you tell a friend?
While tickling them.
Thank you, Nina. Oh, I thought this bit was going to be one-sided the whole time. So through their little choked laughter, you can tell them to go and check out our newest episode. Anyway, I think I'm done. I've burnt all the fuel in this fire. So thank you so much. Get the fuck away from me. Don't make the bit real. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week on another episode of White Collars, Red Hands.